So this is Bill Fry, and it's March 25th, 2020, and we're in Eastchester, New York, and I'm taking this opportunity to interview and learn more from my wife, who will introduce herself now.
I am Ann O'Donnell Fry. This is the middle of our quarantine from coronavirus. So my husband's looking for things to do.
So Ann, you just retired from years of service and work, combined service and work. You did a lot of work with communities. You did work with senior citizens. You did work with volunteers. But there was a real focus on service, and how many years did you?
I don't know. I started working for the Coalition in 1976. So I guess pretty much the only time I took off a little bit was when I had children, and I went to college for sociology. So I was gearing it towards service. But you had asked me previously about,
let me just back up and ask you a few things. So your parents were Irish immigrants, and just say a bit about where you grew up and your family There's a lot there, but just how that shaped you as well.
Yeah, as far as the service piece. Definitely, I grew up in the Bronx in a three-room apartment. Fifth floor, or some people say sixth floor walk-up. And in a very mixed, it wasn't an Irish community, it was a mixed community of mainly Jewish and Italian. We were the odd people out. But starting in the mid-60s, you know, when I started to really realize things, the building started to change. It wasn't the same old-timers. A lot of it changed around 66 when Co-op City opened up. We had a number of people move out to Co-op City. We had to beg our parents not to make that move. But the very first thing that I remember...
There was you and your sister, right?
My sister, Irene. Yeah, my parents and my sister, Irene, in a three-room apartment. But the very first thing that I remember, one of my first memories, is we always had the doors open. You know, it was just a thing. And I think it was warm out. So when it was warm out, you don't have fans, you don't have anything, so you have cross ventilation, so you kept the doors open. Everybody did it. And we're on the fifth floor, we could hear this screaming. And I was probably just turned three, so it really was one of my first memories. And my mother ran out of the house to find out what was going on. And Irene ran down first, and then I ran behind. And you have to remember, five floors, when you're just turning three, you kind of do that pretty slow, one step at a time. And I remember that, like, boom, 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 boom. So by the time I got downstairs, it was on the ground floor that all the people were all around this one apartment, and everybody was crying and screaming. And my mother had already been in the apartment and had come out and was shaking people and saying, "Where is Christopher?" Because there was a little boy that lived in the house, and he wasn't in there. My mother went around to look for him, and he wasn't there, and somebody said he went outside. Now, Christopher's only a year older than me, so my mother ran outside. We ran out after her. We still didn't know what was happening, and I'll never forget Christopher standing by himself at the curb a little away from the building, just staring. And my mother went up to him, and he looked at her and he said, "They said my mother is dead." And I didn't know what that meant at the time, and I don't think Christopher knew, but it scared him with all the people screaming. So my mother picked him up, carried him upstairs. And Christopher was with us pretty much for 3 years. So, you know, it was, you know, his father, you know, his father went to work. His grandmother, he lived with the grandmother. She went to work. Some nights, you know, most nights he would go to sleep down there. But a lot of nights he slept upstairs with us. Especially when he was sick. I remember three of us being sick together, you know, you know, just laying there like, oh, I don't know what we had. I think maybe it'd been measles or something. Three of us quarantined in there together. But that really stuck to me, that the only person looking for Christopher was my mother. Everybody else was just going crazy and hysterical. And then later on, as I said, the building changed. And there were a lot more people moving in who, it was quite obvious they didn't have the means to do very much. And there was a woman that moved in, single woman with three children, three little ones, all under three, like baby, you know, all really small. And she was evicted, but my parents had gotten to know her because she lived on the fourth floor. And my parents probably, I didn't know at the time, my father worked at the AMP, which was a grocery store. So he would bring her the Saturday's leftover stale stuff, which he also brought to us. And he would bring her some things. So then when she was evicted, I guess my parents worried. So one night, they couldn't get hold of her. And she had moved to a building in the White Plains Road and it was underneath the train L. And it was in one of those old buildings that was wooden. And we went in, it was dark, and the landlady came out yelling about this woman and saying that the woman had taken off, and my mother said, well, where are the children? She said, they're upstairs. Now, as I said, a baby. So we went upstairs, and I remember the kitchen, my parents going into every one of the cabinets, opening the cabinets and opening the refrigerator. And I tell you, there was nothing in the cabinets. And I was like, wow. I mean, we only had one cabinet in our kitchen, but it was always full. But there was a lot of cabinets in this kitchen. And that alone was a, whoa, look at all these cabinets, but they were all empty. And so my parents left us, it was at night, left us. Said, watch the children. Now, I'm telling you, we were maybe 8 and 10. And we were watching these three little kids that were sleeping. They were fast asleep. And my parents went around to every bar in the neighborhood to get her and brought her home. And soon after, she I don't think it was my parents. I think my mom told someone else about it. And that person called Child Protective Services. And they took the children away. And, you know, but there was always that piece, you know, my parents, they taught us, when he got the bar, my father bought the bar, he always raised money for the little sisters of the sick poor. I mean, there was always that piece that they were always doing service. So, you know, that was ingrained in us. But then there was also a part of my parents that, it's embarrassing to state, but they were very racist. If a person was white, they were able to help them. I'll never forget bringing a new friend upstairs. I was going up there to get, I don't know, get something. And the friend came with me. She was black. And my mother pulled me inside, slammed the door in the face of this little girl, and told me never to play with her again. I was mortified. I never saw the girl again. Never saw her again. I mean, but that just stayed with me. Oh, of course, it would. You know, it was humiliating. So then I had a good friend, Patty Walsh. Patty Walsh and I, I didn't live close to my grammar school. I had to take 2 buses to go to school. I went to St. Anne's, and I went to St. Anne's because that was where my cousins went to school. And when my parents tried to get my sister in the local Catholic school, which was 1958, they wanted $500. Well, of course, my parents did not have $500. So that's why we just went to St. Anne's, because they didn't even investigate any other schools because they didn't want to be embarrassed again. So they knew that St. Anne's, they didn't ask for that. So that's where we went. And so Patty's parents both worked. And I don't know where, honest to God, she had 3 brothers. They were never there. They must have been with a babysitter, and then the older brother was never around. We had that house to ourselves. And every day, for years, in the summer, any break, I was over at Patty's house. And we'd make our lunch together, and we'd sit, and we'd go and explore different parts of the, you know, we'd explore all over the place. And we even went into the city. We were graduating from 8th grade, and we said, well, what are we going to do this summer? We can't work. No one's going to hire us. And, we're going to be bored. We're sick of doing what we do. She had a cousin who was a nun, who was a Divine Providence nun. So the nun said that we could be CITs, counselor in trainings, at this camp in Palenville.
How old are you?
I was 13.
Yeah.
So I got permission from my parents, and she did too. I think they were both happy to say goodbye. And off we went for the summer. And that was the defining change for me. I mean, these were all kids that lived in foster care, or they were really poor, you know, really poor. And it was a free camp for them. So they did, I think it was like 3 or 4 week sessions. There were 2 sessions. So we took the bus up with the kids. I mean, to us too, I mean, I had 1 black student in my class growing, you know, in St. Anne's. That was it. And there was like 62 people in the class, 1. And it was the Brown family, and they had 10 kids. So that was our integration. He was the oldest. Every grade beyond one grade had 2 because they had twins. So we went there, and of course we were the counselor in training. So we would help out with the counselors, but we also did a lot of kitchen work. And when we lived with this big group of people, that they too were different from us, and they were older. So, it was fun to hang out with older people who, you know, they had guitars, we sang, we joked around. It was just a lot of fun, and just being around these kids and seeing how they, you know, were so appreciative of everything we gave to them. They were so loving. I came home a changed person. So I remember going down, they had a facility in Manhattan, and I introduced my sister to the facility. And what it was, I guess, kids that were taken out of their homes, didn't have foster care yet. At the time, they didn't have orphanages, but they still had this, they kept the kids in this small little room with cots all over it. And some of them were there for a long time. And Irene got a relationship with this. She used to go down there to help out. And she had a relationship with this little boy, Sammy. And it got to be the holidays, and Sammy was still there. And he was pretty much the only one. Poor little Sammy was slower. He wasn't cute. He was like 6 years old. So we asked my mother if we could bring Sammy home. With a lot of fighting and carrying on. Oh my God, I don't know how she finally, I think we wore her down. We brought Sammy home for the weekend. But she made it so hard that we never did that again. Because we didn't want to put another kid through that. But we knew to not involve my parents in a lot of the stuff that we were ever going to be involved, wanted to do in the future. They just didn't understand. That we really, really, I didn't see, you know, I felt, I didn't have much. They didn't have anything. I don't see why we, you couldn't see that, you know.
So you did the counselor in training, and how many years did you do it? You just did the 1 year, or you?
No, okay, so then I went back, I think it was the next year I was a junior counselor, so I had dorm two, which was the 8-year-old girls. And then the following year, my parents bought a house in East Durham, and Irene was getting a job in a local, right down the hill from us was a resort, mm-hmm. the O'Neill House. She got a job there as a waitress, because she needed to make money to, she was going to college. And being that it was the first year, my parents wanted us to take advantage of the house, I took a job there as a chambermaid. So I did the chambermaid there for the summer, which was a miserable, miserable, miserable job. I'm still scarred, I think, by some of the things I saw. But it was interesting. It was a learning, everything is a learning experience in life, and that was definitely a learning experience. But
go forward to when you were in college, you went to
okay, but I stayed, then I went back and I did 2 more years there at 2 more summers at Camp St. Helene. So I just want to let that be known too.
Okay.
Did 2 more summers there. I convinced my parents that I'm not going to be a chambermaid anymore. I think having a lot of big parties too at the house while they were away at work convinced my parents it was not a good idea to leave us there for the summer. So
4 years with the...
Yeah, 4 years with Camp St. Helene.
Yeah.
So then I got to college. And, you know, I went to Lehman. There weren't many, you know, it was a commuter school. You don't... I don't know. I just kind of felt lost there. So I joined the Newman Club. The Newman Club is for Catholic students. Very small group was there. but anyway, the literature there was to go do a summer in Kentucky, in the Appalachians, in Vanceburg, Kentucky. And I had read a book when I was little, Christie, my favorite book from when I was little, a girl in Appalachia. And I just was really curious. My God, this sounds like such a different way of living. Now, you live in New York, you think, oh, you know, you're worldly, you have so much, but in a lot of ways, a very small world. As my husband can attest, when I thought that everybody lived in apartment buildings. But, I mean, I wanted to know what that world was like. So I signed up to go, and it was funny because at the time I was also working at Sears. So I had to take a leave of absence from Sears. And I'll never forget, at the time I was working, I was working in catalog department, and then they had put me into customer service. So I literally had just been working customer service for maybe 3-4 months when I asked for the leave of absence. And the ladies were like, why did you want to do this? Why? You know, they were yelling at me, and I was like, oh God. So I went off. 6 weeks I was there, and boy, now that's the opposite. This is all white poor, and boy, were they poor. And it was very, very different. I mean, when they say hollers, you have to park the car up and you gotta walk down, you meet these, you know, you go down, and they literally, they have no furniture in the house. They had, you know, nothing, holes in the walls filled with newspaper. But you know, I just couldn't get over it. So that was an incredible learning experience, and I was really happy to have done that, to see.
What did you do there?
I taught Bible school.
Yeah.
Which was a big joke, because we really didn't teach Bible school. But that was the whole reason why we were there, is to teach Bible school. But it was just to kind of have a little camp for these kids. It was 3-week sessions. So I did two different places. So I did one at the Johnson House. And I'm not sure what the name of the other people were, but the Johnson House had Buddy Johnson. And Buddy was my age. And he was going, the priest there had got him into a college in New Jersey. And so when it was time for me to go home, the priest sat me down and said, I want you to be responsible for Buddy. Take him on the, he's never been outside of Vanceburg, Kentucky. Take him on the bus with you and make sure he gets to college. Now I'm not 19. so I take Buddy back with me on the bus with his cowboy hat, and literally, you know, you go to college. I see the kids go to college now, they have all this stuff. He had, I don't even think it was a suitcase, it was a satchel, you know, and he had nothing, the poor thing. So I don't know how he made it, but anyway, we got there, and got into Port Authority, which, now we're talking 1974. The city was a very, very different place. It was Midnight Cowboy all over the place. And here's Buddy with his cowboy hat on, and we got on the subway to go home. And I tell you, we had stares like you wouldn't believe. People just like gawking at us. And Buddy had only one pair of jeans, and they had a huge stain on them. I mean, he bought them from a resale shop. So, and we said, Buddy, and it was in a very, very precarious spot. So we said, Buddy, you can't wear those pants. And he said, I don't have any other pants. So my sister was dating somebody at the time, and I literally had no money left from being away. I mean, when I tell you, we scrounged money, we begged from other people that we knew, and we got enough money to buy him. We went down to the village and bought him a pair of jeans. I'll never forget it. His first thing that he ever bought at a real store. So that was my, so there was all these little pieces that kind of led me to working and feeling fulfillment of working with people, you know? That eventually, and then what brought me to work at the Coalition.
The Coalition is what? Explain that.
Is what led me to work as a tenant organizer with the Northwest Bronx Community and Clergy Coalition was we never had any heat growing up. I never had enough heat. I froze in our bedroom. We just froze every year. And then, as I said, the building had gone down, and there were people who, it was a schlep to take the garbage out where I grew up. It was, you had to go down the 5 flights of stairs, go around the other side of the building, all the way to the back of the building. It was, if you were in a rush, it would take you a good 10 minutes, 10, 15 minutes out of your way. So what they started doing was just leaving it outside in the hallway. And it was disgusting, because it was bringing in rodents, and it was smelled bad, and I just couldn't get over it. So I mean, it's my parents' apartment, and, you know, I'm fighting with people, like especially my next-door neighbor who was doing it constantly, and saying, take your garbage down, and then we'd have these fights. And so I knew Joe Mariana, who was an organizer for the Coalition, and I talked to him about it, and he gave me information about how to run a tenant meeting. So I put things under people's doors and I had a tenant meeting. But when you've lived there your whole life and you're 19 years old, people, they pay attention and they don't pay attention to you. So they said, yeah, you're right. And then they didn't do anything. But I had caught a bug. And I realized when everybody came down and everybody was sharing all this stuff about the building, I'm like, it can be done. It can't be done maybe in my building, but it can be done. And I really want it to work for the coalition. So I told Joe, and it was funny because Joe said, well, at the time they didn't have any jobs. Hold on.
Okay.
So at the time they didn't have any openings. But then they got this money from the government. So Joe told me that there were some jobs available. So, and he was having a party at his house. So he said, come on over, they're all gonna be there. Well, it was not the best time to go see these people who were at a party, these organizers who were not themselves. Especially this one gentleman, Bill Fry, who, this was the first time I met Bill Fry. And obviously he had a very bad day because he was sitting by himself. Joe introduced me to him and I said that I want to be an organizer too. And he looked at me and go, why would you want to do that? And I was like, oh gosh, this guy is really negative. So I kind of went away from him and got my resume to Jim Mitchell, who was at the head of it then, who was the director. He hired me to work with Joe in Kingsbridge Heights, and I became a tenant organizer. And
you did that for how many years?
Two years as a community organizer. Then it wasn't just a tenant organizer, it was a community organizer, because then I was in charge of the Parks and Recreation too. They have different committees. So I did Parks and Recreation. That at the time, parks were a mess. Playgrounds didn't have swings, all the equipment was broken, it was dirty, it was a mess. None of the benches had slats on them. So we were always trying to meet with the head of the parks department to talk about that. But so that was, it kind of grew. But then in 1978, they started this, somebody got a grant, and I don't even know who got the grant. It's called Buddy Buzzers. And it was for senior citizens living in bad neighborhoods. There were a lot of push-in robberies. People would follow them home from shopping, push them into their house and steal things. It was kind of very sad, a very sad time. And then all these new people were moving in and they didn't know their neighbors. So this buzzer situation was, you'd hook a buzzer up in their apartment and it would be connected to maybe the next door neighbor or to somebody who lived above them or below them. And God forbid they were in an emergency, they could push the buzzer and their neighbor would come and help them. They had the key and they would, you know. So that meant that they had to have a connection at least to one person in the building too. So a lot of times it was introducing the two together to try to, so that was good. It was a good feeling to be able to do this, because that was mainly more in the South Bronx that we did things like that. I worked
So then you had a period of time where you had children. And so you took some time. You did work, but you worked by watching other children. But there were some things that you did in the community where you lived, which was you organized both through your church in terms of related to food and in the community related to childcare, right?
Well, you know, as I said before, it was a different time. It was not an easy time. And, we wanted the best for our children, and the best thing to do, like, we, when they were babies, I started play groups, and that was, honestly, that was a lot, had to do with, I needed socialization, so I needed to see my friends. But then we saw how much the kids were really needed it, so we did that. We started play groups, and through the play groups, we realized when they got to be nursery school age, okay, well, we can't afford the nursery schools. So then we heard about this cooperative, doing this cooperative nursery school. So we investigated it. We talked to people from Bank Street, which was a school in Manhattan for teachers. They kind of walked us through how to do things. And we started our own nursery school. So and that grew into quite a big thing. So we had two classes. Puffins were the 3-year-olds, the Chipmunks were the 4-year-olds. So I did that, all the kids went through it. So, but then we were also very involved with our church, and we were seeing more and more people in the neighborhood, the community, who didn't have enough to eat. So we started a food pantry in the church. And then we felt, okay, there was, you know, there were some kids that didn't have anything for Christmas. So we had a Christmas gift drive. And that they all became very successful. So it was a time of really being involved with the community. I had, a lot of it had to do with the strong friendships that I had too with people, that they too were very, very committed to doing things for the community. And that helped, because that was my social network too. So that's why we did things like that. So.
Yeah. And then you ended up, which is a whole other story, you ended up being very involved in doing senior care, both by visiting people's homes, by renting up buildings, by also working with a couple of large facilities and directing the volunteers in those particular facilities. So it really became more of a focus to work with senior citizens and connecting them to services and housing. But your whole career has been one that was shaped very early by something that you were gratified with, and you ended up making it work for yourself and for so many others, and that's really great. It's really great for people to understand that it's a long kind of history of doing it for different reasons, and it was, some of it was your family shaped you, some of it was through your religion, and some of it was through just what you decided was important, right?
Yeah, thanks, Bill. Yeah. I kind of fell into working with